Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. This is your host, Zachary Strebeck. I am a California game lawyer and the host of the show. Today, I have got... I never asked how to... How do you pronounce your name? Covey?
It's just like love you, but love with you. A C. Okay.
Covey. All right. Today, I've got John Covey, board game designer and the owner of Genius Games. And I just found out a gaming professor. So welcome, John.
Hey, thanks a lot, Zach. I'm happy to be here.
Professor John? Professor Covey? I don't know. What do you do? What do you go by? Is there an honorific? You call me Esquire and I'll call you Professor. How about that?
There you go. Esquire and Professor. I just tell my students to call me John.
Okay.
It's weird. Yeah. I feel like I'm so young. It's weird to hear him call me like Mr. Covey or anything else.
I feel the same way. Yeah. Mr. Covey is my dad. Mr. Strebeck's my dad. So call me Zach. And that's fine with me. I'm not young, but I feel young. I don't know how old you are, but I'm 37 and I don't know. I still feel like I'm in my 20s. So,
yeah, you know. I'm 31 and I definitely feel like I'm in my 20s. When I hear someone's in their 30s, I'm like, oh man, they're so old. I'm like, you're in your
30s. I feel the same way. Yep. Yeah. All right. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into game development?
Yeah. Okay. So I have a pretty interesting background with gaming, and I'll try and keep it short. But I started gaming pretty young. I mean, you know, we played family games like Monopoly and Sorry and Trouble quite often. And then I got into D&D when I was maybe 11 or 12. And that just opened my eyes to this whole new world of gaming through RPGs. And I would try and design stuff really informally just for fun. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, as a young adolescent, it's hard to really get your mind around a quality system that people can actually interact with and have fun. The kind of stuff that I now look at as a quality game design. Back then it was like, oh yeah, you know, if you move that and you roll the dice and oh, that sounds really fun, but nothing really credible came of it. And then when Settlers of Catan came over, I played that the first time. I think, I don't remember what year it was, 2008, 2009. I don't remember when it came over exactly, but sometime around then, I was in college and some buddies showed me that. And, before then, like D&D was the only game I played outside of some of those mass market games like Monopoly. Sorry.
Right.
And that really opened my eyes. Then when Ticket to Ride got pretty popular, I started playing that. And then I sort of jumped in head first and just started buying every game I could get my hands on and playing with my friends and kind of became that guy. When we're hanging out with friends, I'm like, hey, you guys want to play a board game? And they're like, oh, not that again, you know? And then I quickly realized I needed to find not new friends, but another group of friends enjoyed board games. Right. So I got involved with some, weekly gaming groups, which has been really helpful. So how I actually started the company, I've taught chemistry for a number of years and I was teaching this chemistry class and getting so frustrated with my students because I couldn't get them to memorize any information about like basic structures of how the universe works. And I'm at this gaming night one night and these gaming friends of mine have the power and defense and special abilities and all this information about this like sci-fi dragon race that doesn't even exist. I don't remember exactly what game it was we were playing, but it just kind of blew me away. I'm like, why can't I get my students to remember information like that? So I thought, hey, why don't I design a game about chemistry? And this was right around the time when Compounded was coming out on Kickstarter. It hadn't actually come out yet, but I started designing this game called Atomic Zero about this sci-fi world where everything was based on some different principles of chemistry, or it was like a post-apocalyptic. And so the apocalypse had changed things. And anyway, it was a learning game, but it was terrible. It was really, really terrible.
Okay.
And as is every first design, right?
Sure.
But I just disciplined myself to learn about it more and more. Just the process of designing a game and what good games are and what things to look out for and, you know, just good practices. And through that process, I became better at it and published my first game in May of 2014, Linkage, a DNA card game published to Kickstarter. then published my second one in October of 2014, and then my third again in May of 2015, and then my fourth in October of 2015. And we're working on a bunch more right now, and also worked on a couple other games with some other game companies. So, excellent. Yeah, so that's kind of my background.
Great. Let me ask you, as a chemistry aside, gauge how exciting it is that they've filled out the periodic table now? Is that true? I see these headlines, but I'm not really a science guy. So,
yeah, I don't keep up. I don't keep up as much.
Okay.
I do remember seeing in the news that there were some new elements found.
Yeah, I think they created some new elements to fill the periodic table. So,
yeah, so that's pretty awesome. Yes. I think I'm more excited about a new gaming release, though,
to be honest. right. Things have changed. You're no longer teaching. So you're no longer teaching chemistry. Now you're teaching game design, right?
That's right. Yeah. This is my first semester teaching game design at Webster University in St. Louis. The university put out a call for game designers, someone to teach essentially a board game class. Wow. They have a video game design. They have a video game major in their school communications, and they wanted their students to be equipped to have conversations about board games. So here I am teaching a bunch of animators and illustrators and video game designers about board games. It's a blast. I love it.
So what kind of what's on the syllabus? What are the main topics that you talk about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we talk about things like what's the difference between tactics and strategy in games, mm-hmm. The difference between theme and narrative arc, how to create a game that is elegant, and what is emergence in a game. So how do you get things that arise, emerge out of a game that maybe you didn't intend or create in the game? And then just like depth versus complexity. How do you design a game that has low complexity but a lot of depth, right? So these are the kind of things we talk about. And in the game, we go through we cover some of the major mechanics, deck building and worker placement and card drafting, and we talk about some of the major games that have really revolutionized those mechanics. And then we try and design a bunch of games of our own. And by a bunch, we go through a lot of exercises during class,
right,
to learn how to maximize the amount of game you can get out of the fewest components. And then as a project, the students have to design a card game, a dice game, and then also a children's board game. So it's just not enough time to really get into a meaty, big box board game.
Right.
So we're keeping it light. But if we had two semesters, we could spend an entire semester or even a year on just how to design, a big box game.
Right.
And then we also get a little bit into the business side. You can't just design any game you want to design. Right. Right?
Feel free to fly me out there and I'll guest lecture for a class.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
tell them about copyrights and stuff.
Yeah, that would be awesome, actually.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in your budget, but that's pretty exciting. Do you feel like teaching about game design sort of makes you a better designer, because you're sort of solidifying all the important things in game design, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm curious whether it's going to make me a better designer or not. Right. It definitely gives me more credibility that I'm not sure I really deserve. And so I think some people, when they hear, you teach game design at a university, then they automatically assume you're a great game designer, which might not be the case.
Right.
I don't know. But I do think it makes me a better game designer, because I have to really boil down the fundamental components of design. But at the same time, what I don't want to do is take a lot of those things for granted because I'm teaching them and talking about them so much, which I think is maybe one of the consequences that if I'm not vigilant to.
You mean assuming that you're an expert, or assuming that those things are already going to be in any of your designs?
Yeah, I think so. Or because I talk about the topic so much, mm-hmm. Just feeling it must already be ingrained in the design because I've already talked about it so much and focused on it so much. When just because you've talked about it doesn't mean you've actually done anything about it. And it is interesting now that I'm actually teaching to to think about in my own designs. Like, am I implementing the things I'm talking to my students about when I'm designing games? And sometimes I'm like, no, actually, I haven't even thought about that. And I tell my students to think about it all the time.
Well,
so it's interesting.
Most, if not all of your games, well, I guess, I don't know. Would you consider Tesla versus Edison an educational game or just a game that is sort of based in scientific themes?
Yeah, no, I definitely would not consider it an educational game. Right. It's very accurate to the history behind some of the major inventors in that time frame. Mm-hmm.
Some history there, but it's not like covalence, let's say, or something maybe that's a little specifically educational. Okay.
Right. And I do a lot of, I should say, outside of just my own company, I do a lot of designs with other people and for other companies.
Right.
I publish games through my company that are accurate to some science concept. Mm-hmm. But we do a lot of designs even in-house for other companies and pitch to other publishing companies quite a bit.
So why don't you talk about some of those designs and what you've done?
Yeah, sure. So one that I'm working on right now is a game about colonizing Mars. And I just think it's a fascinating topic. And then The Martian came out, mm-hmm. and that, you know, really got it popular. And Origins in 2015 was themed after Mars. And I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was colonizing Mars, but just the idea of traveling to and living on Mars. And you see this a lot in media right now. And so I thought, hey, why don't I design a game about this? Because it's something that fascinates me already. I tried to get the Martian license, and I talked to Andy Weir, the author, and we had an agreement worked out. And then they realized that they had already sold those merchandising rights to 20th Century Fox. So talked to 20th Century Fox, and it's a little bit more expensive for the licensing rights through them.
Yes, it is. Yeah. When you get big players involved, then yeah, the money, the zeros start adding up. Definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
And so right now, that's one game I've been working on. Actually, Jamie Stegmeier at Stonemeyer Games has shown a little bit of interest in it. This game won the Stonemeyer Design Day that he hosted back in, I think it was like September of 2015.
Great.
Which was pretty great. Jamie did not play it during that, but since then he's come into the office and played it, and he liked it. We're still trying to work out some kinks and see if it's something he actually would want to publish or not. But so that's one that I've been working on. And I've also been working with a children's game publisher to design games for like 4 to 6 year olds and 6 to 8 year olds. So just really trying to boil down some of the basics and design some games for a totally different audience, which has been really fun and very challenging.
Awesome. Well, so science is a big theme in a lot of your games. Do you find that games that talk about science, at least from an educational perspective, it's very lacking in the board game market?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think there's many games that have accurate science themes. Actually, I know for a fact there's not many games with accurate science themes. And a majority of the ones that were designed to be educational are just really, really terrible games. Mm-hmm. I think they were designed to be educational by educators educators who lacked any experience in game design.
I understand. As a former edutainment game creator, I in the computer game space, I understand. Usually the educational portions of it definitely overshadow the making it a fun game portion of things. Yeah.
Right. But we try and not do that. At least we try. We'll see. The customers are the real judges of that, I guess.
Well, how does it work from a design perspective? Tell me about the process. Do you start with the science? Do you start with the idea? Do you start, where do you start?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is something I'll even briefly go over what I talk to with my students about. So I usually say there's three different areas of design you can start with. And this is fairly flexible, right? There's no textbook on board game design. But just from my experiences, what I've noticed, you've got an idea for a new mechanic. So we call that in our class mechanics first design. And then you've got an idea, say, for a theme, you know, a Western or a combat game about, you know, this society versus that or something like that. Sure. And, you know, that's theme first. And then you've got this more vague idea of like experience for first design. Like a lot of party games and social games might have some components of this where you have an idea like, I want people to interact like this. I want this experience to come out of it. And you design a game for that. Now, rarely do games ever start with just one of those things. Usually there's sort of this moment like, man, wouldn't it be cool if like this mechanic was based around this type of theme or you know, something like that where a couple of them come together. But but maybe someone actually starts off specifically with just one idea. And that's actually what we do only because with the games that we publish, I start off with an idea for a very specific theme. Like I want a game about how our bodies build proteins. That's what I want. So I do start very specifically with a theme in mind. I have no idea about the experience. I have no idea about the mechanics. I just have an idea about the content that needs to come across through that game. And then what I essentially do is I boil down or summarize that entire process and figure out, okay, if these are the major components in this process, what components in a game could represent these components? And then once that system or that pathway is sort of structured, I figure out, okay, now like how can we create a catch here? How can we create like some kind of interesting decision or some kind of hook? So it's not just you're moving along this pathway, but at each milestone, there's consequences to decisions that you could make. And those consequences could have immediate or long-term benefits and costs. So that's kind of the whole process that I use. So I really do most of the time start specifically with a theme in mind when I'm designing games for my own company. Now, a lot of times I'll be out at a gaming group or something and I'll play a game and I just really love a mechanic I find. And I think, you know, it would be cool. I could change this mechanic just slightly so that it actually does something like this instead of that. And then out of that, maybe I'll design a whole new game based upon this mechanic that I was thinking about. And I listened to the Ludology podcast, which is phenomenal. I love that podcast. Yep. And they're always thinking about new ideas of mechanics and things like that haven't been done. And that whole, wouldn't it be cool if? And so a lot of times I will design games based upon some idea that just kind of comes out. And those a lot of times are the games that once I polish it up, I'll pitch to other publishers or see if, you know, there's some other way we can retheme it with a science theme and possibly publish it to Genius Games, but that hasn't actually worked yet. So a lot of times we pitch those out to other publishers.
Okay. What is the market like for educational themed games? Are there specific places where you have to sell them to get attention?
Well, It's an interesting question. I'll give you my answer, but I'm not sure if it's the right one.
Okay.
I haven't been working in the educational game sphere for very long.
Okay.
But I'm in it full time now. So, I think there's a huge market for it, right? There's a lot of talk about STEM initiatives and, there's a lot of controversial topics out there just about education across the board. We don't need to get into all that, but anyway, there's a lot of talk out there. So the market is there.
Right.
I think right now part of the trouble is that educational games has such a terrible stereotype from Absolutely. From the crud that has been produced just to make profits and capture that market.
Right.
So we are in some ways fighting an uphill battle. Now we try and design games that can fit both in front of a gaming market and in a classroom. And we have educators and teachers using our games in 41 countries across the world in their classrooms. And so I know that they are effective at communicating science content. We also have gamers from all over the world who send me messages daily about how much they enjoy the games that we designed and how impressed they are at how we've been able to communicate those science concepts if there are gamers that are, you know, science nerds and they really get it.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is find, you know, where that overlap between the science-minded gamers and parents and educators, where that overlap is. We've so far had the greatest success through Kickstarter because it's kind of a tech-savvy community. And then second to that, we sell direct through Amazon. And we have a few stores across the U.S. who are selling our games, who are stores that are not just game stores, but kind of like mind game stores or focused like on games and toys. Marvel's
type of place.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. We're not in Marvel's, but they do have a copy of each of our games, and I do need to reach back out to them to see where their interest is.
Right.
But yeah, so we try and focus on that market and find out where it exists, where those people are online currently. I think the trouble is a lot of gamers are like, oh, so it's educational, I don't want it. Right. And a lot of the educators are like, oh, it's really a game, not like an instructional method. So sometimes you have to just say like, you've got to, sometimes you got to create your own market, and other times you just have to communicate why this is valuable to each of those sides.
Absolutely. Wow. Very. You had a great answer for that. You seemed like you weren't too confident with it in the beginning, but I think that's a very good answer. Yeah. But yeah, well, you're right. You do have to create your own market.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is tough, but I think the key there is just finding the overlap for that market, you know, and fighting those stereotypes.
Yeah. The stigma against educational games is pretty bad. At least from quote unquote real gamers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So have you ever tried to design, maybe you're designing something around a science concept and the science itself prevents it from being fun, right? Like you said, you're using the real world outcomes of various things to create the outcomes in the games, right?
Right.
Has ever been sort of a big stumbling block where you couldn't get past because it was based in science? Do you find it to be a limitation at all?
Yes. Yeah. I would definitely say that we have tried to design games based upon concepts and it just didn't work. Uh-huh. One that we're in the middle of right now, we've been in the middle of it for probably 2 years now, is designing a game about Gregor Mendel and his pea plants, mm-hmm. just the basics of like hereditary genetics. And you and I have talked a little bit about some of the struggles we've had with that game, but we just can't seem to hammer out the mechanics. We can't seem to get the mechanics to really, I can get the mechanics to work, but I can't get it to be fun. And because of that, like, you know, I mean, you can take any science concept and you can throw some mechanics around it, right. But it's either going to, just do terrible justice for the accuracy of that content, or it might not be very much fun. And I think the struggle that we've been having is, we've got mechanics for it, but it's just not any fun. It just feels like you're sort of going through an exercise. Right. And, you know, I've got ideas about how to fix it and we've worked on it a lot, but at this point it's kind of like, do I want to keep wasting time on this if it just is apparent it's not going to work? But maybe at some point we will find some way. I think that's the beauty of playing lots and lots of games, lots of different types of games. You know, if you're just into worker placement games, then you might know a lot about worker placement, but there's so many other mechanics out there and so many other ways that components can interact with each other and players can interact through the game system and through the components. And if you don't get out there and experience all of that, you know, party games, mass market games, your hobby games, role-playing games, you know, miniatures, like everything you get your hands on and see all the different kinds of mechanics that exist and ways that people can interact, then you know, I don't think you're doing justice for yourself. So that's one thing that I've been trying to do is just like play a lot of other types of games and see if there's anything I can find in those that would help me become a better game designer when I do hit those roadblocks for myself.
Excellent. That's why you don't have time to learn about new periodic table elements, right?
That's
playing exactly, every game. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Awesome. So as a teacher, if you could teach listeners, just if you had one thing to teach them about game design, what would it be?
That's a good question. Oh,
you said you could think on your feet, and I'm trying to throw you off.
No, that's good. I've don't worry. I'll think on my feet. I've got
like, is there one lesson where at the end of the course you say you plan to say this is what I want you to take away from this course?
I think the problem is there's so many answers that I want to give.
Right.
So maybe I'll give a couple of them.
Okay. feel free. We have 20 more minutes.
Okay. So I think the ideas of elegance and emergence are huge, 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 huge.
Yeah.
It sounds complicated, but it's really, really not. Elegance is essentially a minimal amount of rules with the deepest amount of game play available. Right. So how do you design a game that's really simple? You've got two or three rules. Everyone knows the rules. It's not hard to teach the game. You can do it in a minute or two. And how do you offer an incredible gameplay experience from those just few sets of rules? I think that's a huge challenge. A lot of beginning game designers will do is when they run into a roadblock or a challenge, they'll add a new rule or they'll add more components to try and fix something that's broken in their base game. And I would say it's a terrible habit to get into, and it's only going to make the game more complicated and probably less enjoyable for the players. So that's what I would say. Focus on elegance. And a lot of times out of extremely elegant games, you have emergence. This player interaction that you never thought would exist, or this new interaction or mechanic or something that happens and just arises out that you never intended for it to arise out of there. And really simple, elegant games, I think you see this a lot. So that's the first thing I would say. The other thing I would say, which kind of piggybacks off of what I was just talking about, is if I could give anyone advice about how to be a great game designer, I think the formula is really simple. I think it's you play as many games as you can, then you analyze all the games that you play as much as you can. You think about them, you break down the mechanics, you talk to people about them, you critique them, you talk about what's great about them. Like from you approach it as an academic. You ask yourself tons of questions about why it's a good game, like why that mechanic worked, where the interaction comes from, where the catch is in the game. And then lastly, you design a ton of games and you do the same thing. You analyze those as well. And I think that process of playing lots of games, analyzing lots of games, and designing lots of games just back to back to back is gonna really hone your skill and hone your brain to think about a game as just an overall cohesive system. And how do you optimize that system? How do you make it fun? So that's probably what I would say to answer that question, which is a lot. But
no, that's a lot, but that's great. No, there are definitely things to think about. I have a question about emergence. How can you effectively build that into the game? Or is it something that is just sort of a happy accident when it happens?
I feel like maybe you did trap me there.
Well, no, and it's fine. I mean, it's definitely something to shoot for. And I think your point about elegance and maybe open-endedness in the game design, as far as what the players actually do, is something that maybe creates emergence, right?
I think the simplicity helps because, you know, if you have a ton of rules, then I feel like you're approaching the game from the perspective of what can't I do? But when you have three rules, you're now approaching a game from the perspective of what else can I create from this simplicity?
Right.
And so I think that's really key. And a lot of times, like maybe there's not a ton of emergence that arises out of a highly mechanized and restrictive game, like say a worker placement mechanic versus a negotiation game.
Yeah.
Right. With worker placement, it's not like you can get real creative with how you place your worker, but with a negotiation, you can negotiate in a lot of ways. And so I think maybe part of it is, if you're designing a game that seems to have really standardized mechanics, like a worker placement or like a card draft or, you know, anything where it's really clear what that mechanic does and how it functions. One thing I like to try and do is figure out if there is a way that players can interact or use some kind of social deduction or add some kind of bluffing into that where you're not just placing a worker or drawing a card, but there's some sort of social engagement or interaction that happens around that. Now, much easier said than done, right? I'm sitting here talking, I don't have a game in front of me, but just being able to add some kind of interaction where players have to make decisions based upon what other players do or say, I think is one of the keys to that.
Excellent. Great answer. All right.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about Kickstarter and statistics. Yeah. One of your big contributions to the community has been your blog, where you look at the stats behind a number of Kickstarter campaigns. What drove you to do this?
Yeah. So at one point in my life, I was doing a PhD program in public health, and I was taking this biostatistics course, well, number of courses on statistical models. And it was not fun. but I was really heavy into Kickstarter at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought Kickstarter was so fascinating. And there were all these questions out there like, hey, what's the best day to launch on? And mm-hmm. what's the best month to launch? And I thought to myself, if I could get the data, I could not actually confirm whether there was the best day or the best month or something like that, but have data to say, well, this is the month that the most funding
right.
comes out of, and this is the month that the most or the highest success rates. We see the highest success rates, and so I decided to do it. I had a guy I was working with at the time write a bot that would scrape the Kickstarter websites, the Kickstarter website for all the past projects. Mm-hmm. And he compiled all that information into an Excel sheet. And I uploaded that Excel sheet. I analyzed the information in a couple different ways. One was with SPSS, which is a pretty powerful statistics tool okay. that I had at the time because I was in the PhD program. But so we analyze it with that, and then I sent a post out on Facebook and asked a bunch of friends and read a bunch of blogs and tried to figure out, hey, what are the questions that people want to know that I can that I can answer with this information? And so that's how it started.
All right. So what are the big takeaways? What's the best day? What's the best month? What's the best hour to launch?
You know, okay, so I'm gonna equivocate a little bit here. I think the biggest takeaway is that none of that really matters so much.
That's my next question. Does it really matter? Yeah.
None of it matters if you have a solid campaign.
Right.
I think off of everything, what we've seen, if we really dig into the data and start to pull out specific projects, whether they launched on a Wednesday versus a Tuesday just did not matter. Whether they had an audience that they were tapping into and they had people waiting for that project to launch and they kind of created their own audience months, even years, sometimes beforehand. That's what really, really mattered. Whether they marketed their campaign properly. So I think there are a lot of keys to having a successful Kickstarter campaign, but after all the statistical analysis that I did, I'm not sure if I would base too much of it, on that stuff. So, right.
It's almost like a security blanket or something for someone who maybe hasn't run a campaign or doesn't feel confident in the content of their campaign, right? And they say, "But I'm launching it on Tuesday in February," and right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And I get people like criticize the blogs I have on Facebook and out there online all the time.
Yeah.
People on the
internet criticizing. Yeah.
Yeah. And most of the time I'm like, hey, look, I use this one quote, when I started it, which I love. Let me pull it up real quick. I think it's like, there you go. One of them is I can prove anything using statistics except the truth.
Right.
And the other one is statistics are used much like a drunk uses a lamppost for support, not illumination.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And yeah, so that's kind of what I think about statistics. It's good. We use it all the time to say what we're doing is right. But if you just take the data and you base your entire campaign off of that and you fail to do a number of other really critical things, you're going to fail.
Yeah, it's almost like a more of a high level thing, right? Like you've run your campaigns, you know how to market it, and you've got all that taken care of. Well, maybe how can we tweak things to make it quote unquote perfect, right? To release if you have to. I agree with you, though, that the right. content is really the important thing. When you launch it, it doesn't seem to be too important.
Right, right.
But there was a recent campaign, I think, that I wrote about on my blog where basically the campaign had gotten stopped halfway through because of a trademark issue, right? Another company had claimed trademark infringement. And, validly, I think it was a valid claim. But their post or their campaign got taken down for like 3 or 4 days. And when it got put up, the timing worked that it now ended at like 3 in the morning or something like that. Right. So they're not getting that last few hours that, and it's still funded. Brass Empire was the original name. I think Steam, crap. Now I'm forgetting what the name of the game was, but yeah, when it ended, it didn't end at the time that he had planned. So all of that kind of got thrown off. And well, I guess it may have cost it money, but in the end, I mean, he funded the game, and I don't know. I just wonder how much of that really has an effect on everything. I don't know.
Gotcha.
Do you find that those last, you know, the last 12 hours or 3 hours or something like that, is that like the most crucial time? Are there valid statistics in that respect?
I think the first 2 days are the most critical time.
Okay.
For a number of reasons. The last day, yes, is a day that usually people get a lot of funding, especially compared to say the middle of the campaign.
Right.
But I don't think it makes or breaks the campaign as much as the first couple of days. I think the first couple of days really set the precedent. And if you think about, think about it from the perspective of a backer. I look at Kickstarter campaigns all the time, and I back a lot of them. I just love, you know, backing the ones that I look cool, that I think are cool. And one thing that I look at when I go is, you know, does this look credible? Are other people actually supporting this? If it's 3 days in and I'm the fifth backer, I'm probably not going to back it because it's clear that something is wrong here.
Yeah.
Now if it's like day one or day two and they've got a few thousand backers, even if they haven't hit their funding goal, because it's say $100,000 or $200,000 or some huge funding goal, maybe it's a big video or something else. Or, mm-hmm. I'm still thinking, wow, it's really credible because they have that many people this early on. They must have done their work to build their audience. They must really have a credible product if 1,000 people are willing to back this.
Right.
And so you see those two things, and I'm much more likely to back a project that looks really credible. And so I tell people, you know, on day one, you need to have all of your immediate audience in there backing on day one. If your friends and your family, if your mom is not backing you on day one, come on. Yeah. I mean, there's a problem.
Yeah, and there's plenty of failed projects that you see that had zero backers, and you got to wonder, don't these people have any friends or anything?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, honestly.
Yes. It's very sad. Just to clarify, yeah, the game I was talking about was called Steamcraft, but then transitioned into Brass Empire. So Brass Empire is the final name.
Got it.
In case everyone's paying attention. Okay.
Yeah, I just looked at it. It looks really cool, actually.
Yeah. It looks great. I backed it because I actually blogged about it, about the trademark issues in there.
I thought
it was interesting because the creator blogged about his experience, which I thought was interesting because he had a lot of big misconceptions about trademark law and how the process works. And I thought it was interesting. So I wrote something to try to answer some of his questions. I don't know if he cares.
Gotcha.
I may try to get him on the podcast at some point to talk about that experience.
Yeah. I think that'd be really interesting.
I mean, that's gotta be soul crushing where you're halfway through your campaign. And I understand that every day is super stressful. And especially during that sort of mid campaign lull, then it gets taken off of Kickstarter and now your backers can't find your project. And I mean, it's gotta be horrible. Have you had any really stressful times during your Kickstarter campaigns? Something like that? Maybe not that big, like being taken off Kickstarter, but you know, just
definitely nothing that big. I've had a lot of really stressful times throughout the whole process.
Right.
Not a terrible amount, like right in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign. I feel like that would make it even worse.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most stressful thing to deal with during a Kickstarter campaign is just criticism from people that you feel like isn't really deserved.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're putting yourself out there. You're putting your name on the line. And so people, you kind of are inviting people, if they would like to criticize you publicly in any manner, you are giving them the opportunity to do so. And sometimes people take advantage of that. And that is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
That's probably the most stressful thing I've had to deal with during a Kickstarter campaign. Post Kickstarter campaign, we've had all kinds of problems.
Okay. Well, actually, we're running near the end of this episode, so maybe I'll have to have you on again to talk about all the fun problems you had after the campaigns.
I would love to.
Yeah, I actually just talked to Jamie Stegmaier two episodes ago, and we discussed that sort of the backlash from the crowd, and especially during the first couple days of his Scythe campaign, and you know how that affects you and how that affects the campaign, and just how much importance to put on the sort of the negative influence of the it's usually a vocal minority that's against you, right?
Right.
You know, the internet is a dark place. I even, that was the first line on my, I wrote about defamation law and how that deals with Kickstarter creators on Jamie's blog. And yeah, I mean, you know, there may be legal issues, but mostly it's sort of a PR issue. How do you deal well with criticism online?
Right.
Because like you say, right, you're putting yourself out there and you need to stay professional. There have been plenty of stories of creators going nuts. And yeah,
It's the worst thing you can do because you turn your allies.
Yep.
Well, I mean, this has happened to me a few times actually, where someone was just being incredibly rude, and I would treat them back in a very gracious and kind manner and tell them that the way that what they said hurt me and affected me, and I would appreciate if they didn't speak like that. And then tons of the other backers would jump in. Yep. Like, I can't believe you would say that to John. He's such a good guy. Exactly. But if I criticize this guy and like, you're an idiot, you know, get the F off my, you know, and I just went crazy. No one's going to back me up anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're going to think I'm a lunatic or something.
Kill them with kindness, right?
And yeah. Kill them with kindness.
Really professional. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the number one key. Anytime you, especially people I have turned people who were completely against me into allies, into very vocal allies, by just treating them extremely kindly when they were inappropriate or rude. And because they recognize it, they look back at what they wrote and they think, man, I was really rude with what I said, and this guy treated me so nice. Like, he must really be a good guy.
Well, when you're interacting online, you often forget that it's a human being on the other end of the computer, right? You're just typing words. And yeah, that's the lack of the face-to-face interaction can actually change the whole conversation. So
absolutely.
Hold on 1 second, my phone's ringing and I'm gonna
just gonna
wait until it's, because my mom has this, I mean, I'm staying at my mom's place for a couple weeks while I'm visiting for Christmas, post Christmas.
Gotcha.
She's got like the phone rings everywhere, and there's like the caller ID talks out loud, and every time you open a door there's like bells going off all over the house. I mean, I don't know. It's like, is that an old lady's house? I don't know. Everything's like, when you're watching TV, the caller ID comes up on the TV, and it's always
right.
They get more phone calls than anyone else. I don't get it.
Anyway. That's hilarious.
All right. So they're finished. So I'm going to wrap it up now. All right, John, I think that's going to do it for this episode. I think we're out of time. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a blast talking with you.
I love it. I can't believe I haven't had you on sooner. So I'll have to have you on again to discuss more about Kickstarter. I mean, you know, people love to talk about Kickstarter, and I'm sure you also love to talk about it. So
I do. It is my life.
Yeah, I understand. Where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, they can find me in a couple of places. On Facebook, we've got gotgeniusgames.com. So the company is Genius Games, but all of our social media handles have a got, G-O-T beforehand. Yep. So Got Genius Games on Facebook, gotgeniusgames.com is our website, and then at Got Genius Games on Twitter.
We should do a Kickstarter campaign to buy you the geniusgames.com. It's some weird Bitcoin site I remember looking at it before.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating. The guy will not sell it to me.
I understand. Yeah.
It's right. Fine, though. Whatever.
No problem. You can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development. And make sure to help us out. Put a review on iTunes. Just click 5 stars and that's it. That's all you need to do. And lastly, patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the Patreon campaign. All right. And goodbye, listeners. See you next week.